All right, so we're back in building 112. Joe Duffy, Charles. This must be parallel computing. What's going on?
Exactly. So in the last few videos, we talked about the stuff that we released back in 2007, November, December of last year, in our CTP, test parallel library, parallel link. And we've actually been hard at work on our next CTP, which is available now on MSDN, on our dev center.
Excellent.
So the idea is today we wanted to walk you through some of the cool new stuff that we've added. And we have a bunch of other people that work on the team here.
All right. Excellent. Hey.
Hi. My name is Hussein Yildiz. I'm a developer on the PFX team. I work on the task parallel library project.
Excellent. We've seen you before. You were on the first TPL.
Hi. My name is Igor Ostrovsky, and I'm a developer working mostly on PLink.
Yep. Remember that? It was a good interview we did.
Yeah. I'm Steve Tope. I'm a program manager on the concurrency team, and I focus a lot of my time on the task parallel library and something new we'll be talking about today, a set of new coordination data structures.
Interesting.
Hello, I'm Ed Essie, program manager for PLink and also project driver for parallel extensions.
Excellent. All right, Jess, take us away. What's new? What's going on?
All right. So we basically have added an entirely new pillar. So, you know, TPL, PLink, we had in the previous CTP. We have a lot of extensions that we've added there. Mm-hmm. And we have an entirely new category of things that Steve mentioned. We call CDS. It's a collection of cool new concurrency data structures or coordination data structures, depending on what your favorite transliteration of the acronym is. But I figure I'll just throw up on the whiteboard kind of
cool.
The stack of technologies we have, and then I'll let these guys dive into a lot of the details. So just a reminder of what parallel extensions is. So we have this parallel link thing, which was in the previous CTP. This takes, you know, link to objects queries and automatically parallelizes them for you using kind of classic data parallelism techniques. So you can take any link query and parallelize it pretty easily.
Nice.
In the previous CTP, PLink was built on top of the CLR thread pool, which was kind of strange given that we had this new task parallel library thing that was meant for scheduling tasks.
Yeah.
Called TPL. Remember, this has the parallel class, so you can do parallel at for each, and it has these task objects that you can use to cancel work and inquire about their status and that sort of thing. And so what we've done in this CTP is PLink actually built on top of the task parallel library.
Nice.
Which is how we originally intended it. The reason why it wasn't in the previous CTP was basically two technologies kind of grew up separately, and we're now doing the work to make them happy together.
Great.
And so what you'll not actually see, it's not apparent in the APIs, but mm-hmm. it's something we've been hard at work on. We have a scheduler. The original TPL kind of shipped with a prototype scheduler that uses work stealing and more efficient scheduling techniques than the CLR thread pool, but we've actually been hard at work. We have an entire team that's not here today that does just the scheduler. And it's probably worth talking with them
Absolutely.
At some point in the future. The team is roughly the same size as the team of people building PLink, TPL, and the other thing, CDS. So a lot of engineering time going into this.
Excellent.
And TPL builds on top of that. So you see this nice little stack here. And, of course, TPL is kind of where we envision parallelization technologies going in the future. So you can imagine something else here that would target TPL. And kind of this is where the layer of higher-level abstractions around TSLs and that sort of thing. And cutting across all of this, we have something that we call CDS, which is a lot of detail there, but things like concurrent collections, synchronization primitives, things that capture really common patterns in concurrent applications, like lazy initialization and that sort of thing.
Nice.
And the nice thing is a lot of these came about because we needed them when we built the scheduler, we built TPL and PLink. So, in fact, there's these kind of dependencies here. The CDS types are actually being used all throughout the stack, which is really good for proving that they're useful and that they're designed correctly. So this is all available in the CTP. So obviously you're probably wondering what we've done here, what we've done here.
Yes.
Like I said, this is all new. And then obviously this is all new as well. So we can start with one of them.
Okay.
I'll let you pick which one.
Well, I'd like to start actually with the new one.
CDS?
Because you mentioned new data structures and things like that. It's very interesting.
Yep.
And the way that it spans all of them. And then it would be fun to basically go from the bottom up. So we start maybe quickly on the scheduler. TPL, we had an extensive talk on. It'd be nice to know what you've done in TPL that's new.
Mm-hmm.
How much of what you guys have done in the CTP is based on developer feedback.
Yep.
And also, I'd really like to know how you pulled this off with writing it all in managed code.
Yeah, okay.
Because I think that's kind of interesting.
Okay, sounds good. One thing I'll mention before we dive into the details is that a lot of the work that we've done has been on kind of performance, reliability, tons of bug fixing. Actually, a lot of the stuff that we did is based on customer feedback in the forums.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, email exchange, internal customers, we have a lot of them. So
all right.
Definitely listening to people. If people have feedback, definitely drop us a line.
Great.
So to go through CDS, I think maybe Steve,
yeah,
do you want to
cool.
go through that?
All right. So the CDS is interesting because it's really kind of a grab bag of a whole bunch of useful things. We needed a lot of them for Feeling, as Joe said, TPL, the scheduler, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We need them. Other people are going to need them. And so we're basically adding a whole bunch of things to the system.threading namespace and then some sub-namespaces as well. So in this CTP, you see about 10 of these new types coming online. And in future releases, you'll see a whole bunch more.
Okay.
This is sort of actively under development. To give you a taste of the kind of things that are here, in the system.threading namespace, we've got primitives that range from the extremely low level that we expect folks that are in very, very advanced scenarios to use, and we've got things that are much, much more commonplace that we expect lots of folks to be using in all of their concurrent applications. So, for example, starting with kind of the lowest level, because it's what's being used in the scheduler and TPL, we have a new struct called spinway, a very simple type, but it implements common and efficient and correct spinning behavior. So I'm writing my code, I can create one of these spin weights somewhere. Enables new spin weight. And then at some point I can say spin weight dot spin once. And it does an appropriate spin. If I were to call this thing in a loop, every single time I call it, it's actually doing some back-off behavior. It's saying, you've already called me a couple times, I see that, I'm going to do something slightly different this time, kind of figuring out the best way to do it to ensure optimal performance for your application.
So let's quickly just talk about, I mean, when you think about before you name things, right? So we think about spinning up a new thread, and
yep.
waiting on threads and
yep.
whatnot. Spin weight, what yep. does it mean? Explain that.
So...
what does it do? Just by, tell me what it does, just looking at it. What does spin weight dot spin once mean?
So we'll start with, so a common way of naming things in .NET is you start with kind of the core thing over here, and then you can add adjectives as you work your way up, right? So at its heart, spin waiting is waiting for something. It's just
okay.
waiting. And there are various types of ways that you could wait in an application. You could wait by blocking on a kernel primitive. Another thing you could do is just sort of ask, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Which is, in effect,
polling.
I'm polling. I'm yeah. spinning. And so that's exactly what a spin weight does. At a very high level, a spin weight would basically be for int I equals 0, while I is less than spin count, we'll call it, I plus plus, done. So it's just a loop. Now, this isn't correct spin weighting behavior because it's not doing a lot of things like supporting hyper-threading like it should, dealing with single proc machines like it should. A spin weight on a single proc machine is pointless.
Mm.
But the idea behind a spin weight is you want to, you know something's going to happen imminently. You don't want to take the full cost of a context switch or diving down into the kernel and so forth. You think that by spinning just a little bit, by being just wasting just a little work, you'll actually save yourself from wasting a whole lot of work.
Okay.
And so there are a lot of scenarios, and in fact, a whole pretty much I think every data structure, close to all the ones we have in CDS, use spin weight in some fashion. And we use them throughout the scheduler, TPL, and VLink.
Excellent. Now, just one quick question. Given how lame the thread pool is in the CLR, and that's no offense to the CLR people, I mean, and to Joe, since you were on that team. It's gotten better, though, you know, now that we're in 3.5. It's not like they haven't done any work.
They've been doing a lot of work.
So my question to you would be, have you worked with that team at all to sort of synchronize... APIs in some sense. So in other words, you know, you're using system.threading. They own that namespace,
yep.
right?
So we are working very closely with the rest of the CLR team. We don't have a lot of things to announce at this point, but
fair
we'll
enough.
Do future videos, and I hope we'll have some more interesting stuff to talk about that.
Got to keep them interested.
Exactly. Come back for more.
All right, cool.
All right. So this is an example of the type of thing that we have at sort of the very low level. Built on top of SpinWave, we have a very simple spin lock. So you have locks in .NET like monitors and so forth, mutexes. The idea behind a spin lock is we're not going down into the kernel at all. It's totally user mode. It's basically we're going to spin waiting for this lock. Is it available? Is it available? Is it available? Is it available? Mm. And for certain situations, this can actually be quite beneficial. Now, I say these two things are for really advanced scenarios. We don't expect most developers to need them, but there's a certain class of developers working on a certain class of problems. For example, implementing concurrent libraries where these things can be quite valuable.
Okay. So one thing I did want to point out is that both of these things are structs. So another nice thing about the spin lock is that, you know, if you want to use a monitor today, you actually have to allocate a GC object, right? And then if you're waiting on it, there's a chance that it will inflate. So this is the terminology they use for when the monitor actually needs to wait, if there's contention, it actually has to allocate a kernel event. And so there's a lot of allocation overhead. And once that happens, the GC has to scan these things to figure out when to deflate something back and release the handle. So the nice thing about SpinLock is that it's basically a single word. That's the overhead. So you can feel free to embed that into a data structure. And you know, for really fine-grained locking, say you had a linked list and you wanted to have a lock for every node, you probably wouldn't want to allocate a new monitor for every single node, but you might think about allocating a spin lock.
Cool.
So, exciting.
All right. So moving right along, I wrote up a couple existing types here. If you look in the .NET framework, there's currently a manual reset event and a semaphore. Just like in .NET 3.5, we introduced a reader-writer lock slim, which is kind of like a slimmer, better in some sense version of reader-writer lock. We've also we're introducing a manual reset event slim and a semaphore slim. The main idea behind these types being that if you use the existing ones, basically right off the bat, you're allocating kernel synchronization primitives. Here you're calling create event, create semaphore, etc. And then every time you do a wait or a set on one of these guys, you have to dive down into the kernel and so forth. These manual reset event slim and semaphore slim try and do everything in user mode if possible, and only lazily instantiate these underlying events and only dive down into the kernel if they absolutely have to. And under the covers, they're using things like spin wait to try and avoid doing that if at all possible.
Nice.
We've also have a new type of event we're introducing called the countdown event. The idea here is you're waiting for a certain number of things to happen. So you've done a typical fork join where you've kicked off 10 work items. You'd initialize a countdown event to say initial count of 10. And then every time something completes, it would just call countdown event.decrement. And only when it hits zero does this thing actually get set. So it's not an incredibly complicated data structure, but it's one that pops up over and over and over again in these sort of concurrent scenarios. One of my favorite types we're introducing is a lazy init type. This is one of those types where I think that many, many, many developers will be able to take advantage of this in their code. So an example of using this, let's say I had something, a very expensive data structure I wanted to lazily initialize such that I only create this thing in my code when I actually need it, but I don't want to have to worry about, in my code, figuring out whether it's already been created, locking, doing interlocked operations, etc. I might say private lazy init of my type. We'll call it empty. And assuming my type has a public parameters constructor, that's actually all I need to write. And then later on in my code, rather than just using MT, I can use MT.value. And this will give me back the lazily initialized my type. So this is sort of the one way to use it, but we provide a whole bunch of different approaches to actually using this thing. If I wanted to, I could actually say new lazy init with my type. And then I can give this thing a delegate that returns create my type. So some function that does whatever I want it to in order to generate one of these things. And again, this type under the covers handles all of the necessary threading mechanisms to ensure that the right thing is happening, that we're not stamping all over other threads doing things. We can take another step further. I can, as another parameter, I can pass to this a mode in which this lazy init operates. So I can say, for example, lazy init mode dot allow multiple execution. which is the default, which we saw earlier. And this basically says, if there are multiple threads racing to create one of these things, allow them to, but only publish one. Mm-hmm. So this would be in a scenario where I only expected one thread to be accessing it at a particular time, but if they happen to have multiple ones, it'll still do the right thing. If I really want to ensure that this create MT function or method is only ever called once, I could change this to ensure single execution. And this behaves as if I were taking a lock every single time I were accessing this thing. We don't actually do that, but we ensure that this function is only ever executed once. Hmm. And similarly, I can just say MT.value, and I get the value back, and we're good. There's a third mode, which is thread local, which is one of my favorites. Basically, this says, when I call mt.value, I'm going to get back an instance, basically the result of calling create mt just for that thread. So every thread that accesses value will actually get its own instance back. And so as long as I don't explicitly then hand out that instance to other threads, I can be sure that I'm accessing it in isolation, unless I don't have to lock on or anything like that while I'm using it. Hmm. So it's a pretty powerful type with lots of different ways of getting at its functionality. And this is an example where we really love feedback on, are we providing the right modes and the right ways of accessing it. So let us know.
Excellent.
Just one other thing to note. About the motivation of this type, one of the common themes that keeps coming up over and over again in the context of C++ and Java and .NET is lazy initialization and how to do double-checked locking, and is it broken with the memory model that CLR provides or not. And there's actually a lot of kind of misinformation out there on what patterns to use. So we actually find throughout the BCL, people implement lazy initialization differently. They'll stick in a memory barrier here or there because they're not quite sure. Mm. So this just kind of abstracts all of that away for you.
Excellent.
This is also one of my favorite features.
Very nice. Yeah, it's cool. I mean, and I know that, for example, lazy typing, which is popular amongst Eric Meyer and his crew,
the
functional types, and as well as the work that's being done with F#,
right?
This isn't the same context, but it's an interesting... Laziness is good.
Yeah, we're lazy around here. We just sit around, drink beer, and we don't actually do work.
Well, programming is one of those places where the term lazy actually doesn't...
It's a good thing.
It's a great thing.
Yeah. I mean, Link is fully lazy, right? I mean, that's... but we shouldn't get too much of a rabble on this, but it does kind of... It's mind-bending, right? I mean, the fact that Link is lazy is a great thing, but it's also somewhat of a hurdle for people that aren't familiar with it to get used to the fact that when they write the code, it doesn't actually execute right where you wrote it. It's only when you access the value that it gets written. And it's a similar concept here, actually.
Interesting. But that's important stuff.
Another really neat thing about this type is it's incredibly tiny and very, very little overhead. So if I actually declare it the way I originally declared it, I'm not doing any allocations whatsoever until it's actually invoked. It's also, if you look at the implementation of it, we have a minimal number of fields so that the cost of using this inside of a class or something is, for most situations, negligible.
Excellent.
Which is really cool. I just mentioned one other type in the system threading namespace that we're introducing called write-once. Mm. The idea of write-once, it's, in a sense, kind of like read-only, you know, in C#, where you can set this thing in a constructor and then outside of it you can't do anything with it. It's read-only at that point. Write-once is... similar concept, but it's kind of inverted. It's basically, we're only able to write to this thing once. It doesn't matter if it's in a constructor or elsewhere in my application. Once I've written to it, any additional attempts to set its value throw an exception. And similarly, I can't read from it until its value has been set. If I try to do that, I will actually invalidate the whole thing and kind of root out difficult problems that would otherwise be very difficult to find in my applications. Synchronization problems where one thread happens to be reading from something before it was actually available. Okay. So lots of neat primitives.
Absolutely.
There's another namespace we're introducing as part of this coordination data structure work, system.threading.collections, which are a set of thread-safe and scalable collections for a whole variety of different concurrent programming needs. So starting at the lowest level, we have a new interface called iConcurrent Collection. Which basically represents a collection that in a thread-safe way I can add or remove from. I can put something into it, I can take something out of it. And in this CTP, we have a couple implementations of this. We have a concurrent stack, FT, and a concurrent queue, FT. And these are collections that you can use in your application, and for most situations, you don't have to do any sort of additional synchronization around them. So a common pattern, if I had a stack of T using the existing stack type in .NET, I might say while s.count is greater than 0, then I want to use s.pop. So I'm iterating until the stack is empty. While the count is greater than 0, I want to use the result of whatever this thing came off the stack. With the concurrent stack, I can basically say concurrent stack of T, S, and we'll do the same thing. And then let's say my data, I have my T here, so it's, we'll call it little data. Then I can just say while s.trypop out data, going curving down here as I reach over, use data. So very similar in style, but just different enough that we're capturing the common pattern of getting something out of it in a thread-safe way. Here, I would have to lock around the access to both s.count and s.pop, because someone, if I were to check s.count and saw it was greater than 0, if another thread came along and removed something from s before my s.pop, it would blow up. Here, that happens in one fell swoop. Try-pop. Try and get something out. If there's anything available, give it to me. And that's sort of a common theme. If you look at the APIs that we're exposing through our concurrent collections, they're not identical to the other the non-concurrent generic versions that you would find in system.collections.generic. They're similar, and you know, stack provides a push, concurrent stack provides a push, mm-hmm. but we don't provide a pop. We just provide a try-pop. We also provide an is-empty rather than just a count, so that you can quickly check to see is there something in here rather than checking the full number of items that are in there, mm-hmm. Which is both because we want to encourage that more than checking the count, and because in our implementations, getting the count can actually be much more expensive than getting the count from some of the other mm-hmm. other collections.
Interesting.
So we have these right now for stack and queue, and we're working on some other data structures for or other collections for future releases. But one of my other favorite types that we've introduced in the CTP, in addition to lazy knit, is a locking collection.
Before we move on to I just want to mention that the stack and queue, for people who are interested in lock-free algorithms and the implementation details,
absolutely.
We actually, those are both lock-free, so it's kind of interesting trivia, I suppose, but anybody familiar with Win32's notion of an S-list, which is a singly linked list which uses lock-free techniques, you can kind of thread nodes together, mm-hmm. We actually use pretty much the same algorithm there, which is actually used throughout the scheduler, and it's really useful in low-level high throughput scenarios where taking a lock and having a thread possibly context switch out while it still holds the lock can cause, you know, massive convoys and backups waiting for that lock. Mm. And so the algorithms we use are pretty clever and sophisticated.
So one of the questions I'd ask, just as sort of a sidetrack, we just started a new series on Channel 9 that calling algorithms and data structures. And the idea behind it is to get a developer, engineer, program manager, whatever your title happens to be, a technical person who knows what they're talking about, on a whiteboard, talking about a single algorithm that's interesting enough and how you solve it.
This was Mike Swanson's...
Mike Swanson was the first one.
For PDC or technical.
You got it.
Planning.
That was the initial episode of that, because I was thinking about it, because with going deeps, we have to kind of be a little bit more broad.
Yeah.
But it would be nice from developer to developer, kind of, you know, here's a hard algorithm, here's a creative solution to it. So when you mentioned that, I thought of that, because we probably don't have time to dig into what you're thinking.
Right.
But we should do that.
Concurrent queue is actually very interesting. Maybe we could pick that one to go into, because it's interesting because the algorithm works, but tolerates the potential for threads stomping on each other and invalidating each other's work. So occasionally, a thread will fail to make an update, but it's okay because the queue is still in a consistent state. And then the next thread to come through actually notices, hey, there's something wrong here. I'll fix it up for the guy that got stomped on. And so it's actually a really interesting algorithm.
Absolutely.
And that actually brings up an interesting point about a design choice we've made with our concurrent collections like concurrent stack and concurrent queue. If you look at the existing collections in .NET, well, if you're enumerating over them and you try and make a change to the collection while you're enumerating over them, mm-hmm. it's actually an explicit invalid scenario. It throws an exception saying this collection was modified, you can't enumerate over it. But we think that for concurrent collections like this, you will want to be enumerating over the elements of the collection while you're modifying it. So we actually support that. So you can be looking over all the elements in the stack while another thread is adding to it, and it will continue to work. which is, I think, a very nice property for a lot of applications.
Mm-hmm.
So the final type I'll talk about, and then I'll hand this over to other folks to talk about PLINK and TPL, is our blocking collection.
Mm.
This is sort of your typical CS 101 or OS 101 data structure for producer-consumer scenarios, where I've got some threads that are producing work and then other threads that are consuming that work. And you can do this handoff using a blocking collection. So I can create a blocking collection. Of some type T. And then somewhere, some thread can call bc.add and can give it some data. And somewhere else, another thread can call bc.remove. And this line here is guaranteed to return data because he will block until there's actually data available for him to get. So you can have a whole bunch of threads, there can be many of them adding to this, and a whole bunch of threads removing, and they'll all do the correct thing. We have, provide a whole bunch of overloads for these to pull and to try remove and provide timeouts and all that kind of stuff. But the really interesting thing is more what happens up here. So there's some parameters we can pass to this thing. For example, in addition to just blocking on remove, we can actually provide to this an upper bound. So I could say, I only want this collection to be able to hold 10 things. And if more than, if someone comes along and calls add and tries to add the 11th thing, it will actually block. So it's an interesting way of throttling producers in a producer-consumer scenario where they're running faster than consumer and you don't want them eating up all these system resources, so you can throttle them back. But the really interesting thing is we don't dictate the underlying storage mechanism that's used in this blocking collection. So in the CTP, if I create a blocking collection, under the covers, it's FIFO. It's using, in effect, a concurrent queue. But I could actually provide my own here. So I could pass in a new concurrent stack. And now the blocking collection under the cover is LIFO. So if I add things to it, when someone else calls remove, they'll remove the last thing that was added. Or if I wanted to be explicit, I could pass in a concurrent queue. And in fact, blocking collection accepts as a parameter any implementation of iConcurrent collection, which both of these guys are, but anyone can implement their own. So as long as you implement this to provide these thread-safe add and remove methods, you can then plug it into a blocking collection. So if you implemented a priority queue, and then you implemented this, and you could use locks internally or whatever you wanted, you could then provide that and kind of get this blocking wrapper, blocking and bounding wrapper around your priority queue.
Okay, so one question that I would have, and you probably already answered this, but it's hard to use a camera and dig in an interview at the same time, even though I've done it for so long. What if I want to have a blocking collection wrapped around a collection that I didn't write? So a collection that doesn't implement iConcurrent collection.
Then
is that okay or not?
So blocking collection won't accept it directly, but you can very easily implement a few line wrappers. So you write your own collection, you know, public. Let's say you had a collection called My Cool Data Structure. Right?
Okay.
I can implement a My Cool wrapper, which implements iConcurrent collection.
Okay.
And then internally, I have my add method that takes some data. This is a T. And internally, I could just store an instance of, what did I call it, my cool data collection or whatever it was. And I could do something like lock D, D dot, you know, add to whatever the name is on my actual collection, and I can just store the data into it. And now when I can implement remove in a similar fashion, and now I can pass my cool wrapper into the blocking collection.
Excellent.
So you can do things like that. The one last thing I'll mention about blocking collection, because I think it segues nicely into PLINK, is that we provide some interesting ways of consuming blocking collections. Am I getting too far away?
No, it's fine.
Okay. So if I have my blocking collection, I can actually say get consuming enumerable, which will give me back enumerable. This is easier with IntelliSense. And this will actually give me back an IEnumerable that in effect calls remove under the covers for every call to move next.
Mm.
So I could for each over this as a consumer. I can say for each var data in blocking collection dot get consuming enumerable, And then I'm acting as a consumer that's continually calling remove, 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 taking things out of it and processing it internally. But this is an IEnumerable, so I can actually use it in plink or in link in general. I could say var q equals from d in this and have some huge link query here that's processing this data on that's all coming in from possibly many, many other threads, and then I select out my result on d. And then later on, I can foreach over this query. So you can kind of see how all these things plug together and integrate with the TestPar library and parallel link and so forth.
Absolutely.
You might wonder also if that enumerable will ever stop producing information. So, Steve.
Mm. Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, if this were just a loop that was continually calling remove, it would never end.
Yeah.
So we provide support for producers to say adding complete, or complete adding. I forget which. We went back and forth on which order the verb a producer can call adding complete, and then when it gets to the point where there's no more data, this will return as if the enumerable had ended. Mm.
But I mean, just from a design perspective, I mean, you'd imagine that you'd never want to have a never-ending execution. You never want to have code that never ends, right? So why have to explicitly call adding complete? I mean, why not have the system take care of it? I don't understand.
So this blocking collection, as I'm enumerating over it, I'm basically saying, give me the next thing, which is effectively calling this bc.remove. And the whole purpose of bc.remove is to block until more data is available. We're sort of assuming that somewhere else in the universe we're waiting for someone to do something. If those people aren't going to do any more things, then they need to tell us that.
Okay.
Now, that's not to say the code is at a loss here. If no one called bc.complete adding or adding complete, as I'm enumerating over this var data in Q, I could make some decision in here, and then I could call break.
Mm.
And even if this wasn't done yet, even if folks were still adding to it, I can still stop consuming it.
Okay. Or just create a new method called try remove, and just
we have
I never have to do anything.
Yeah.
But that's
with try remove,
the way programming is going these
even
days.
Even if you provide a timeout to try remove,
yeah.
If I said wait 10 seconds for something, someone could come along and add something at the 11th second.
Got it. So just be explicit and call it and move on.
Exactly.
Right on.
This is an awesome way to consume feeds. One of the scenarios that financial customers run into a lot is that lots of stock ticks keep coming in. And as the ticks come in, they want to do something and make a decision whether or not to do a trade based on that stock tick.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a case where you might not want it to end, or you'd want it to end at close of business, close of trading day.
Mm-hmm.
But you could just really keep having it come in. If nothing's come in yet, if a new tick hasn't come in for a while, Plink just blocks and waits until something comes in,
mm-hmm.
and then data comes in, and it manipulates that again.
Interesting. So have you tried, Joe, playing around with this stuff, say, inside of a always-running service? Because what you just mentioned was kind of an interesting scenario. So let's say I wrote a Windows service that uses this type of code, and it's always executing, waiting for things or whatever. How does this handle, over time?
So it will work well. I mean, obviously, if you're using a blocking collection and you're going to use plink, which will parallelize access to that blocking collection, ideally, you'd have enough work coming in to saturate all the processors to keep them busy. Otherwise, maybe parallelism isn't the right thing. You just end up with many threads blocked waiting for input all the time.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is a great segue into kind of the underlying question.
Yeah.
When is parallelism the right thing to do?
Right. So if you have a steady stream of incoming data, and there's a lot of data readily available, and or it takes a long time to process any individual item, then it's definitely a great scenario. Now, the service case, though, if you have data coming in all the time and you have a lot of work to do for each piece of data, and you're going to run it as a service, you better be willing to accept the fact that your processor is probably going to be pegged at 100% the entire time. So it's kind of the kind of thing where you'd want dedicated machines to processing feeds, which in the financial scenario, definitely you'd have servers or even client machines set up that are just spending all their time processing data. So it's definitely a legitimate scenario.
Excellent.
You did ask an interesting question, which is figuring out where parallelism is important and figuring out where you might not be best taking advantage of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
Joe mentioned we have a separate team working on the scheduler here. We also have a separate team working on a whole bunch of great tool support. And so for folks that are attending Tech Ed this week, next week, whatever it may be when this video goes live, they'll get to learn a little bit more about our plans there.
Are you guys going to Tech Ed?
We are. I'm going to Tech Ed, right. And Steve Tashira from our tools team.
Nice. Yeah, he used to be a C++ punk.
Exactly.
Now he's moved over to the concurrent world.
Yep.
Not that the C++ team isn't also working on interesting solutions.
Absolutely.
Because there are, and that's something that I wanted to talk about a little bit. I don't know if it's going to be yet another interview, but it is important for native developers to understand that they're invited into this party you guys have created.
Absolutely. And also, one of my sessions at TechEd, you know, Joe mentioned there's a whole team working on the scheduler. It's not just focused on the managed scheduler. There's an equivalent to this basically entire stack, except for PLink, which doesn't really have corollary in the native world. Mm-hmm. So it would be great for us to do a drill down into that in some future channel line video.
Absolutely. Cool. So where do you want to go next? Who wants to talk next? That's what it comes up to.
PLink.
Is it TPL or is it PLink?
Well, I think TPL, you asked us to start from the ground up.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So
okay.
I can do TPL.
Thanks for reminding me.
Okay, so I think it will make more sense if we start talking about the scheduler first. So,
sure, good.
As Joe mentioned, we overhauled TPL scheduler and built it on top of a new one, which is a brand new design, has some significant benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't want to steal the credit from those guys. There's a big team who we were working with on this project, so I'm sure you'll be doing further talks with them. But for TPL, I think the main benefits are this new design clearly scales better, especially on hardware which will have 16 or 32 processors.
Mm-hmm.
And other memory models. And another clear benefit is coordination of different scheduler instances in the same process. So there's a component which essentially manages these multiple scheduler instances so that they don't step over each other's way. Can you guys think of anything else?
So let me just ask, just out of curiosity. So the last time we talked about TPL, you weren't built on top of the scheduler.
Yeah, the TPL used to have a custom scheduler. Well, it was.
Or did that work grow out of what you guys did in TPL?
In a way, yes. But this new scheduler has some ideas from this scheduler. At least shares some ideas with the older TPL mm-hmm. scheduler. But it's a new design from ground up.
Okay.
One thing just to highlight, I think that the scheduler that Usain was touching on is mm-hmm. Memory architectures for future processors is.
Yeah.
Right now, it's kind of, there's a lot of uncertainty around what the memory hierarchy will look like, but Intel and AMD kind of have different approaches. But one thing is for sure, which is that architectures will be more NUMA-like. So what that means is, if you picture today's architecture, say you have a quad core, you have four cores here, and there's some, cache on die, and then there's basically, a bus and a main memory. So it's memory, a CPU, and so there's some caching going on, but there's only one memory bank, right? Or maybe there's multiple memory banks, but they're all the same controller.
Mm.
So this is UMA, which stands for uniform memory access. There's non-uniform memory access,
yeah.
Which say you have 16 processor machine, 4x4 cores. Now, the question is, if you had this architecture, so all these were connected to a single memory bank, then obviously this bus here becomes a bottleneck, right? If all the processors are running hot and all of them are touching cache lines, you're going to spend a lot of time just, transferring cache lines back and forth and dealing with all the memory architecture traffic. A new machine will have different memory banks. So, maybe there's four memory banks here. Usually you have more processors per bank, but a lot of server machines are like this, high-end server machines.
Okay.
And so they're all kind of connected in various ways, and you can usually get from one processor to any of the banks, and Windows automatically targets, when you allocate memory, it will allocate on the closest node. So if you allocate memory from this node here, the it'll try to get the physical memory allocated on this memory bank. But unfortunately, if say you're queuing work and suddenly the work is over here and you need to access this cache line, you know, the cost of transferring it is far greater than the cost of transferring it if you're running on this processor. And so this is one of the things where it seems like this low-level kind of machinery that nobody really needs to worry about, but it turns out parallel applications of the future that are actually accessing a lot of memory simultaneously actually will become memory bound because of this bottleneck here. And so the scheduler knows about kind of the layout of the memory hierarchy and can do things like making sure that work goes into the nearest possible work queue, and that if you're queuing work from here that's accessing memory on this bank, it will try to stay near to it.
Excellent.
That's one of the big advances. And the scheduler team, somebody over there can probably go into tons of detail on this. But
I mean, again, it brings up a good point, because we focus so much on the actual execution cores inside of one of these many core processors, and then we forget about other things like memory.
Right.
So we guys are solving the problem from a programmer targeting a machine that has 80 cores in it, which is not too far out in the future. 64 is not too far out in the future. They may be asymmetric, right? They're not all going to be the same type of engine. So you're going to be able to actually say, I mean, one of the things I would ask is, how granular is the stuff you're writing? For example, one of the cool things I like about the technology Volta and sort of the notion of splitting tiers and targeting speed, you could target cores and say, I want this code to run on this species of core that's on this machine. Maybe there's four of the same type. So are you guys going to start, you know, working with other teams? Like, I mean, Volta is just a personal project that I like.
Yep.
But, I mean, it could work in this context.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of different directions
for
processors in the future. Out-of-order cores, which are simpler cores that don't have superscalar execution, you know, instruction pipelining, that sort of thing, which are much lower power. You can fit a lot more of them on a die. It's kind of, if you look at some of the things Intel's talking about, it's definitely a direction that they seem to be headed in the future. GPUs, another very interesting thing. It's kind of a trend right now. GPUs, it's called. And if you look at the accelerator project from MSR,
Absolutely. There's
a lot of great information there. So we're definitely talking to a lot of people. Definitely right now we're focused on what's going to be on the PCs of the next couple of years, which seems to be a kind of out-of-order core, you know, between 4, 8, 16, you know, in that range. 32, obviously, definitely on servers, and 64. We're focused on both client and server, but it's definitely something we're looking at in the future.
Cool. Because, I mean, at some point when you have, it's interesting because, you know, here at Microsoft, we have, the industry has a big problem with parallelism in the future for programmers.
It's an opportunity.
It's an opportunity. But it's interesting because there's a lot of asynchronous innovation that's happening across the company. So you mentioned Accelerator.
Right.
It's a project that's been around for a while, covered on Channel 9, I think 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
Now that's for, you know, data-intensive analysis. Use the GPU. It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
Take advantage of it. Also written in managed code. So it's kind of interesting. Then, of course, we have the CCR. We also have various other things that people are making. At some point, there needs to be some sort of unification. So that developers are like, all they have to think about is, you know what, I want to target C# or .NET, and then the hell with figuring out what libraries I have to freak out on.
I totally agree. The good news is that we're already talking to every team you already mentioned. So.
Excellent. Well, that's right. Well, I just want to, let the people out in the audience comfortable to know that there will be unification. They're not going to have to learn a bunch of different APIs. The CCR, though powerful, is kind of clunky and hard to get used to. You've got to change the way you think about jobs, right? Now I'm dealing with queues, and it's just different way of thinking.
Yeah, the way I see it is there's been tons of research. I mean, even looking past the last 5 years, back in the early 80s, MIT was doing tons of research around actor-based programming, which is very similar to the CCR.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a wealth of knowledge out there. And right now, we're only at the stage where we're looking at how to take all those ideas and actually turn them into shipping products. So we'll take ideas from over here and over here and over there and kind of try to make sure they all work together and they make sense and they're not confusing to try to use together. So
Absolutely. That
is the nirvana we're seeking to reach. So.
Well, certainly there'll be no silver bullet. It's just as long as we tie everything together. It's why I like technologies like Volta, because what they do is they stitch together various other technologies
right.
and present a really interesting and powerful programming model that's not very complicated, mm-hmm. which is what professional developers want. Yeah. But anyway, this is great stuff. So, yeah. So it's good to talk about this stuff because this is Channel 9. We talk about what goes on in the company as well.
So go on with TPL.
Yeah, let's rock on. What's new?
So majority of our work in this last 3-4 months has been about building TPL on top of this new scheduler. Mm-hmm. So fitting things in, replacing some of the previously existing mechanisms like replicable tasks to work on top of the new design. And some performance optimizations to bring things back to the level of the previous scheduler, because this is V1 work after all. Mm-hmm. But behavioral changes and API wise, I think we have a bunch of interesting things to talk about. Let me try to list them here. So first and foremost, we have structured task hierarchies. And this is not necessarily an API change, more of a behavioral change that I'm going to go into in a minute. So we have continuations. What else? A lot of waiting and cancellation related updates that we've made as a result of feedback we've gotten on the forums or in our internal discussions. Actually, I'm not even sure whether we will be making more changes, but there has been a lot of discussions around how waiting and cancellation semantics are utilized, and we realized there were some smoothing that needed to go into the product. So
just one note on that. So we've received a lot of great feedback in the forums and on blog posts and so forth, mm-hmm. about things like waiting and cancellation, as Hussein mentioned. We've decided to take a whole bunch of changes based on that. Some of them have made it into this CTP. Some of them folks won't see until the next release after this one. Mm-hmm. But there are a whole bunch of changes that we're working on. So don't despair if you've requested some things and they don't show up here. There's a decent chance they might show up.
So can you give us an example of how people are using this? So you mentioned you having debates about how people use waiting and cancellation. So what does that mean? What's the debate?
So let's actually start talking about the structured tests.
Okay.
Because that leads into it.
Yeah, that will lead into it. Before that, little more additions here. So in aside from the wait and cancellation story, we also made some changes to the exception handling behavior as well. And we have a new API, which is wait any. I believe it used to be there, but was throwing a not yet implemented exception.
That's a great. I love that exception.
Structured tasks. So what the problem? I don't know. There were so many things wrong with the previous task parenting design.
That's okay.
The best way to put it is it allowed too much ambiguity in the behavior, and it allowed a lot of programming mistakes to get passed without being noticed. So so let me try to give an example. You create a task which itself contains a child task, continue talking over this example here. So one major problem is based on whether you explicitly observe this child task or not, you may or you may not know about its exceptions or other problems that arise with it. Mm-hmm. So now in today's world, in the CTP bits, CTP 0 bits, if this task was exceptional, that's to say, threw an exception, and you didn't catch it, say you do t.wait. So this is nice, because if the task is exceptional, you will know about it. But if you don't do an explicit wait on it, your child task exception is now lost. Mm. And that's a potential problem in correctness.
Certainly.
You could have problems which don't even surface during development time. So essentially, our solution to this problem is forcing an implicit wait on children tasks that get created inside a parent. So if this task hasn't been explicitly waited on, when the parent task delegate is complete, before it itself it declares itself as completed, it actually starts an implicit wait. But we termed it implicit wait, but it starts a wait on all the children that were created within the lifetime of this delegate. So essentially, any exception that was missed from this child, you will know about it when you say you wait for the parent.
Cool. So let me just interrupt one thing. We're going to get booted out of here. This is a conference room, after all.
Sure.
And people love meetings at Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
So they're eagerly waiting to get in here and start jabbering.
Okay.
So why don't we move this party to somewhere else where there's still a whiteboard, and just so people know that that's why this is being turned off.
Okay.
All right?